Hello, and welcome to the C3PME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. 1 year ago, Human Rights Watch published a landmark report on Israeli apartheid. Today, I'm joined by Omar Shakir, the Israel and Palestine Director for Human Rights Watch, to reflect on the reactions to that report and the growing international consensus on apartheid. In addition, we talk about his experience of being deported by Israel, documenting Israeli war crimes in Gaza, and how the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akleh demonstrates Israel's pattern of violence against journalists. My name is Michael Biegert, Vice President of CJPME, and the podcast host for today. I'm very honored to be joined today by Omar Shakir. Omar has been the Israel and Palestine Director at Human Rights Watch since 2016. He's previously worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights in the U.S. and has a JD from Stanford Law. Welcome to the podcast, Omar.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
To start, maybe can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to this position that you have at Human Rights Watch?
Absolutely. So I've been working in human rights ever since graduating from law school. I started actually at Human Rights Watch helping to cover Egypt. I was there shortly after the 2013 military coup. And my major report there actually focused on documenting the killings of demonstrators, including the Rabaa massacre, one of the largest single day killings of protesters in modern Egyptian history, 800 plus, likely over 1,000 gunned down in a span of 12 hours on one day. I then went to work for the Center for Constitutional Rights, where I focused mostly on representation of Guantanamo detainees, though I also did other work, including around freedom of speech. I was one of the lawyers that represented Professor Stephen Salaita in his case in Illinois after he was fired from a tenure track job over tweets about Gaza, and also worked on issues of police surveillance of Muslim communities in the New York, New Jersey area. I joined Human Rights Watch, as you noted, in 2016. I'm the country director, so I oversee our research and advocacy on the West Bank, Gaza, Israel proper. I was based on the ground for about 2.5 years, but you know, the Israeli government, you know, throughout that period, for the most part, tried to restrict my access and ultimately deported me in late 2019. So I've continued the work from across the river in Amman, Jordan, where I'm speaking to you from today.
And when you were deported in 2019. My understanding is that Israel justified that. They said, you know, they were revoking your work visa because of this 2017 law, which I guess bars supporters of boycotts or even someone who boycotts the settlements, that Israel can prevent them from entering the country. Can you tell us a little bit about sort of, I understand there was like a pretty lengthy legal battle of trying to stay in the country and to sort of fight that deportation. Can you tell us about what that experience was like?
Absolutely. So actually, that effort was the culmination of actually efforts that began well over a year before that. So if I sort of turn back a little bit, Human Rights Watch applied for a work permit back in 2016 that would have allowed them to hire foreign employees. That process normally takes 60 days. They applied, you know, several months before I even began my post. The Israeli government took more than 8 months. And in February of 2017, they denied Human Rights Watch a permit to hire a foreign worker. And that decision was based on a determination by the foreign ministry that Human Rights Watch, to quote them, was not a legitimate human rights organization, but rather propagandists for the Palestinians. When we went public with that decision, the Israeli government quickly backtracked and eventually gave the organization a work permit, and I received a work visa under that. So I entered Israel-Palestine back in April of 2017 under a work visa. Literally the next day, pro-government NGOs filed a lawsuit against the Israeli government alleging that their decision to allow me in and allow Human Rights Watch to work in Israel violated a law that had passed the month before actually by chance, it was passed when I was on a plane the first time entering Ben Gurion Airport, although it was based on my entry a month later, that basically instructs the interior minister to deny entry to those the Israeli government determines support boycotts of Israel. Based on that case, the Interior Ministry opened an investigation. They made a determination. They had first wrote to us and gave us a chance to respond to their finding that I and Human Rights Watch call for boycotts of Israel. We, of course, responded explaining that actually Human Rights Watch takes no position on boycotts of Israel or any other country, or even company, frankly. We document human rights abuses and we call on rights bearers, including companies, to not abuse rights, not be complicit in rights abuse. And we, based on that, we've called on companies not to operate in settlements. So we explained our nuanced position, but of course, the Israeli government in May of 2018 decided to revoke my work permit and ordered me to leave within 14 days. We challenged that decision in Israeli courts. We first of all challenged the constitution of a law that essentially imposes a litmus test on who can enter the country based on their perceived positions and work, but we also made the point that Human Rights Watch doesn't call for boycotts and the freedom of boycott should be respected anyhow. That led to an injunction being issued, so we litigated in Israeli courts for nearly a year and a half. The district court eventually ruled against us, and we appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, and there the Israeli Supreme Court in a 3-0 decision upheld the decision, in essence saying that even if you're doing a human rights-based call not to abuse rights, that constitutes a boycott. And even if it's just about settlements, it's still a boycott of Israel. In fact, that's very clearly in their determination. They said how the law was intended to be drafted. So based on that, I was booted out of the country in November of 2019. And of course, my deportation needs to be understood against the wider context of a systematic assault on human rights defenders and human rights advocacy. And of course, the most seriously affected are the six Palestinian NGOs who have now been effectively outlawed. And of course, many other Palestinian human rights defenders that have faced travel bans, criminal charges, and even worse.
Right. And Amnesty International staff have also been sort of hit with some of these repressive practices too, right? There was one staff member who is, I think, a Palestinian staff for Amnesty, was prevented from leaving the West Bank, I think, had a travel ban on them because of the work of Amnesty. Is that right? Are there other cases like this? Is yours the most sort of serious, do you think, of the international groups?
It's definitely not the most severe. I think the case you mentioned of Amnesty, it was worth people sort of taking note of, where this is a campaigner, Palestinian ID holder, in the West Bank, who essentially received a travel ban on unspecified, security grounds. And this was significantly detrimental to his everyday life. This person lived Leith Abu Ziyad lived 3 kilometers from a hospital in East Jerusalem, where his mother was undergoing chemotherapy treatment. And actually, the Israeli government barred him from being by his mother's bedside. She ultimately died without Leith by her side. He also was barred from going to Jordan to attend a funeral of a relative. He was basically locked in. So that was a quite significant case. Of course, the UN human rights expert, including the special rapporteur for the occupied Palestinian territory, their access has been restricted. Investigative mechanisms like the Commission of Inquiry, even the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, their office, they've had difficulties with their visas. But none of this in severity, I think, matches what Palestinian rights defenders, face. Not only the outlawing that I mentioned earlier, but travel bans. We've seen that imposed on Shawan Jabarin, previously Fal Haq. We've seen issues arise in recent weeks, regarding, some of those members of those six organizations. And of course, we've also seen, and it's important to note, criminal charges, administrative detention. For example, Salah Hamouri, a Palestinian human rights defender defender from Jerusalem with Adlamir, who is now being held in administrative detention without trial or charge. He's also, of course, had his legal status, his residency status in East Jerusalem, revoked, and that's currently being challenged. But that gives you a sense of Palestinians face the brunt of it. But of course, there are also restrictions on international groups, and frankly, even Israeli groups who have been the targets of smear campaigns and also face restrictions on their funding.
Mm-hmm. And presumably much of this is designed to make it much harder to conduct human rights work, to have access to the ground. How has your deportation affected your ability to do your work?
Look, I mean, Human Rights Watch has been determined that we will, you know, not let any government, and Israel, you know, is not the only country that has barred access to our staff. I mean, it joins the ranks of countries like North Korea, you know, Cuba, Egypt, Venezuela, that have similarly barred access to Human Rights Watch staff. China, you know, more recently in that category, Russia in recent weeks. And in each of these cases, you know, we continue to do our work. In fact, we cover the same issues with the same methodology and with the same intensity. So we continue to have a field team on the ground in Israel-Palestine working under my supervision. In addition, we use different forms of technology, you know, satellite imagery, open source investigations, a variety of other mechanisms. The Israeli government, I should note, has also restricted access for Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, and many others to Gaza for many years. So we've been relying on these sorts of methodologies when we're documenting, you know, the abuse that have taken place, you know, during hostilities and otherwise. So we've continued to do our work in cases where we've needed senior staff to enter for sensitive research. We've brought in other foreign staff people to work with our local team. I've done interviews remotely. We've used other technology. So we've continued our work. And in fact, I would say our work has, you know, only continued to grow since my deportation, of course, including our significant report finding that Israeli authorities are committing the crimes against humanity of apartheid and persecution against millions of Palestinians.
Yeah, I wanted actually to go into that next. It's been about a year since that report came out. On the heels of other reports from Israeli groups like B'Tselem and Yesh Din. At the time, it was a pretty significant event, certainly to the solidarity community, to have sort of mainstream prominent human rights groups use language similar to Palestinians and to grassroots activists and others. You know, looking back, sort of, it's been a year. Well, maybe first, actually, if you could remind us maybe about just a couple of the key takeaways of that report.
Sure. So, I mean, Human Rights Watch spent several years looking at Israel's treatment of Palestinians. You know, our work generally has focuses on specific policies in certain areas, you know, whether it's freedom to build in East Jerusalem or freedom of movement in Gaza or land access inside Israel proper. But we really sort of look much more broadly at Israel's treatment of Palestinians, but also very granularly. So we did several case studies around Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. We also looked at actually decades of Human Rights Watch's reporting and looked at trends, statistical analysis of the work we've done over many, many years. We then compared that against the established international law on discrimination, including the prohibition against severe institutional discrimination and repression or apartheid. So we looked at apartheid and persecution as legal terms based on their definitions under established legal treaties, including the Rome Statute to the International Criminal Court that exists. And when we applied the facts that we documented over many years to the law, we concluded that the Israeli government is committing these crimes against humanity. This is, of course, the most stark, you know, assessment Human Rights Watch has ever reached on the conduct of Israeli authorities. And the report lays out in great detail the basis of that finding. And, you know, that includes, and again, given that it's been a year since, and I hope many of your readers have, you know, read at least the executive summary or parts of the report or the coverage of it, but it's based on our finding that there's an overarching policy by the Israeli government across Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory to maintain the domination by Jewish Israelis over Palestinians, which largely manifests in the desire to maintain control over demographics and maximize the land available to Jewish Israelis while confining Palestinians to smaller and smaller enclaves. And we explain how that manifests in different ways. And then the second part of the report looks at the grave repression Palestinians face, in particular in the occupied Palestinian territory. And we lay out there, how that amounts in particular ways to systematic oppression as well as inhumane acts, which are two of the other elements of the crime beyond the sort of intent or policy to dominate. And we have strong recommendations that flow from that finding. And those recommendations are consistent with where we found crimes against humanity elsewhere. So they're about ending complicity in all its forms in these crimes, as well as holding the perpetrators accountable in different format. I'm happy to go into more detail, but I think one of the overarching messages of this report, which of course has been echoed by many others, and of course has been what Palestinians have been calling for many years and many decades, is to sort of understand that the underlying reality, on the ground is one of a single primary sovereign that is in control between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and that methodically has sought to privilege Jewish Israelis and repress Palestinians, obviously at different degrees of intensity, and highlighting the sort of need to focus on this single government's policy, understand it, seeing the repression of Palestinians, the fragmentation, but also to sort of move beyond the kind of international discourse in places like Canada, which for so long has sort of repeated tired talking points, right, about the lack of a peace process and the need for a two-state solution, and increasingly turned a blind eye to the transparent reality, reality of one government, in essence, methodically developing a system to privilege one people at the expense of another, and the need to kind of focus on that reality, which is more and more clear. And there's a developing consensus, not only in the global human rights movement, but beyond around apartheid, but also to take an approach that's consistent with the gravity of these crimes, which means that the root cause needs to focus on the structural repression, the structural violence, and human rights, as opposed to sort of dealing with this as a conflict resolution paradigm. We all want there to be peace, but there is no peace process today, and to continue to repeat platitudes about it is actually just providing a fig leaf to apartheid.
Right. And as you say, it is the gravity and the implications of those conclusions poses a huge challenge to existing government policies, certainly in Canada and elsewhere, and should, provoke serious reflection and reorientation. Unfortunately, when the report came out, the government here really tried to ignore it as long as possible. At one point, they sort of had to address it because of this minor political scandal, and the government said that they flatly rejected the apartheid label. And that's all they say about it. All this research that goes into it, just rejected out of hand. Was that kind of the response you saw elsewhere? Looking back, what do you think about their response overall to the report?
I think it's first of all important to understand the degree to which there is growing recognition that apartheid is the reality for millions of Palestinians. There's first of all a consensus in the global human rights movement. You have a number of Israeli organizations, including the premier human rights group B'Tselem, but including other groups like Yesh Din, like Physicians for Human Rights Israel, Gisha, Breaking the Silence, that have used the term apartheid to describe Israel's treatment of millions of Palestinians. Of course, Palestinian civil society has been using the term apartheid for years and decades. You have Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, major global institutions. You have the UN Special Rapporteur for the Occupied Palestinian Territory. And there have actually been statements in recent weeks by a wider group of UN experts endorsing that conclusion. You have even a body like Harvard Law School's International Human Rights Clinic in partnership with the Palestinian group Al-Damir. Even if you go beyond you know, human rights organizations, right? And you start looking much more broadly, you see there's a number of other civil society groups. And of course, these, that's not an exhaustive list of groups. There are others that have been saying this term for years, including in the US and in Canada. But what you've seen, I think, over the last year is that knowledge, you know, the kind of expanding of this term, and it's included legal scholars like Lawrence Tribe. It's included, you know, very prominent media commentators like those at MS, you know, NBC, even prominent pop culture, you know, icons, and even folks inside Israel proper, right? Where you had, for example, last summer, the Israeli Knesset hosted an event with an MK from the ruling, from the coalition, as well as one in the opposition with a banner of 54 years from occupation to apartheid. You have former Israeli ambassadors, two of them, to South Africa. You have the former attorney general, deputy attorney general of Israel, that have used the term apartheid, other senior, you know, figures. Of course, you have former prime ministers of Israel that use the term as a future warning, but now you have people that have sort of moved beyond and, you know, talked about it as the current reality. And you're starting to see leading global figures. We've seen letters that have been signed by several hundred European parliamentarians, dozens of former prime ministers and foreign ministers in Europe, the former secretary general of the UN, Ban Ki-moon. And now you even see governments, right? So, of course, it's been most prominently South Africa and Namibia, of course, countries that have their own experience with apartheid. But at the last session of the Human Rights Council, you actually had the entire African group issue a statement on apartheid, the Organization of Islamic Conferences, which represents 55 countries, the Arab group, which again, obviously overlap with the OIC, but 22 countries. You had 16 other states, the foreign ministers of Luxembourg and France have used the term. I could go on for another 25 minutes just listing more names, but the point I want to make is there is growing recognition. Now, it's not uniform yet, including among countries, but actually the most common position among most countries, and you saw this in the UK, in fact, very recently, was to say, well, it's a legal term, we're waiting for a court ruling, which of course is a cop-out because these same countries make that determination about Russia and Ukraine, about Syria, but, you know, it's when it's convenient here, they hold off on that designation. But actually, it brings me back to your point about Canada, which was the outrageous remarks by the foreign minister when he made comments, I believe, last summer, were actually an outlier, because at the time it was even stronger than the condemnation of the report by the United States. The United States had basically said, you know, this is not a term we use. And so Canada was even more vehement in its position at the time. You know, there have been other states, especially there's been a much more mobilized Israeli government counter-response in recent months. And so there have been other states now that have also made that comments. But look, I think that was to be expected. I think it's worth highlighting, of course, that, like, you know, it points to how deeply entrenched the not only inaccurate analysis and framing is, but how deeply entrenched support and dare I say even complicity in Israel's apartheid is in much of the Western world. And by the way, much of the Western world was complicit with other manifestations of apartheid, like in South Africa. So we have a long road to go, but I think it's clear where all the professionals, the people who work on this for a living, are. It's clear where the states that have human rights that have a clear eye take on this situation are. And it's only a matter of time, I think, before it becomes untenable. And already the Israeli government, by the way, and I'll sort of conclude on this point, which is say the Israeli government hasn't really even made an effort to respond on the merits. Right. They haven't actually found, I mean, imagine, Michael and your listeners, if there was a factual mistake in the 213-page Human Rights Watch report, you would have heard about it very, very quickly, because they would have used that to undermine the report. They didn't find it. They didn't find it in other reports of this magnitude. Their only argument is really to try and attack the messenger, which is the oldest trick in the book. Or it's to try and change the topic. It's to try and, you know, make the topic too toxic to discuss. And obviously, you know, that's an effort that they've had some in some areas, some successful traction with. But, you know, that's really the last you know, quiver they have. And I think over the coming months, we're going to see more and more people, because it's reality, right? Mm-hmm. The emperor wears no clothes. So, you know, you can't deny the facts. So it's only a matter of time before, you know, governments have to face this contradiction. And Canada, you know, is one of those countries that I think that the double standards is so naked and so apparent that it's more and more untenable.
Absolutely. And, you know, even recently when the new foreign affairs minister was asked about this in a committee, I don't know if you saw this, but the opposition parties were challenging the government to explain its position on the amnesty report. Melanie Joly, the foreign affairs minister, said, you know, we reject the report. And then, you know, there was a follow-up question. Can you give us any explanation at all for what's wrong with the report? And they were unable to say anything. You'd think, again, if they have looked at the allegations, they should be able to come up with a counter response. If they think it's wrong, there should be something in there to point to, to say this isn't actually happening, or give some other sort of interpretation. But it's just simply a total rejection of, as you pointed out, the consensus among everyone who works on this issue. But I think so much of like the international community for Canada is just like Canada, the US, Israel, the European Union. Like that is the international community. And then everyone else, the majority of countries in the world, all of the human rights organizations, that's like totally not worth listening to. But yeah, that's totally untenable at some point.
Well, let me add, Michael, I mean, there has been one other tactic, which is the straw man tactic, mm-hmm. which is basically to argue something that we're not saying, right? It's not like South Africa, which is not the art. I mean, the human rights groups have not been making that argument. There is certainly a genre of historians and comparative politicians that maybe are making that claim, but that's not what the human rights groups are doing. Right. The world decided the crimes were so grave that they wanted to universalize them and make them universal legal terms. They never happen again anywhere. So we're arguing against the international legal definition. So that's a bit of one of the straw man tactics that have been used. Another one has been to say, well, you know, they're saying Israel is an apartheid state. And of course, it's a nuance, but there's no legal term of apartheid state, just as there's no legal term of torture state or genocide state. Right. There's crimes and prohibitions. And so, you know, to sort of misconstrue that is, again, sort of an effort to kind of like move away from the substance of the finding. But yeah, to the when a group reaches a determination, it's based on a legal definition, and it's based on applying the facts that we document to the law. Nobody has really challenged the facts that we've documented, which are well established. And by the way, I've done dozens of meetings with governments, including all the governments that, you know, you've highlighted, and in closed door meetings, the governments, you know, we ask them, do you have a substantive critique and for them or disagreement? And for the most part, the answer has been, no, we don't disagree with you on the facts. We just don't agree with the use of the term. And then you push on them on why, and they won't be able to give you anything besides, well, it's not productive, right? You know, and then you sort of remind them, look, our job as human rights groups is precisely, regardless of whether or not it's productive or not, to fairly and objectively apply the facts that we document to the law, right? So, you know, if we were to say, well, it's not productive here, so we're not going to say it, we become just another political actor, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, but even moving beyond that, of course it's productive, because, you know, one of the biggest barriers to advancing on human rights-based actions has been this kind of fig leaf of a peace process. And just to give one anecdote, you know, that I think will make the point. One of my first major report in this job was actually about systematic arbitrary arrest and torture by the Palestinian Authority and by Hamas authorities in Gaza. And I recall being in a certain unnamed European country shortly after that report was released, and I was pushing the governments to, just as we do in this report, you know, cut funding for abusive Palestinian Authority security forces and publicly condemn these abuses for they're systematic, they're torture, they're, you know, et cetera. And the government said, we can't, we need the PA for the peace process. And it just kind of reinforced the way in which the international discourse has become such an ugly spiral and circle that they almost need to keep their head in the sand to sustain the myth that they can't bother, they can't question because their entire approach is built on it. And I think part of what we're trying to say is there's a need to ditch the tired talking points and deal with reality for what it is. The first step to any solution, regardless of what you believe in, you know, is to acknowledge reality for what it is. The wrong diagnosis leads to the wrong analysis, you know, it leads to the wrong set of prescriptions. So I think we need to, you know, ensure that we see things clear-eyed and have an approach that's catered to that reality.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's almost even worse in Canada because official Canadian policy, if you go on the website, like it's not terrible. They have a lot of positions on not recognizing the annexation of East Jerusalem, all sorts of stuff about the occupation. They never talk about that. The Canadian government won't vocalize what it has on its website. I don't it's so rare for them to actually criticize an Israeli action. It's almost unheard of, or to say the word occupation. So it's not even getting to sort of the reality of apartheid. It's even getting them to acknowledge the occupation in a way. It's that bad of a problem. Maybe if we could move to another quick topic, which is just that it's been actually there's another 1 year anniversary, which is the latest Israel assault on Gaza in May of 2021. I know that in the months that followed, Human Rights Watch investigated many of the Israeli airstrikes in Gaza and concluded that at least several of them amounted to apparent war crimes, if I don't have that mistaken. Can you tell us a little bit about those investigations and what you found?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important that we, you know, remember those, not only because we're at the 1 year anniversary, but of course, Gaza, you know, still has not rebuilt. And of course, these, you know, bouts of hostilities take place against the context of a 15-year crushing closure. So while much of the world has moved on, attention-wise, Palestinians in Gaza, more than 2 million, continue to live under that reality of crushing closure, apartheid, and dealing with the consequences. So Human Rights Watch did several different pieces looking at different elements. With regards to your question, you know, we looked at, in particular, several airstrikes that killed, you know, many of the civilians, not all of them, but we focused in particular, I think, on three sets of airstrikes that killed 62 Palestinian civilians. And our, you know, research indicated that, and there were differences obviously with each strike, but in general, Israeli forces struck in areas where there was no apparent military target, which would you know, makes it a clear, you know, violations of international law and apparent war crime. And they included, of course, the strike that took place on May 16th of 2021 on Al-Wahda Street that itself resulted in the killing of 44 Palestinians, including a couple of families that were almost entirely wiped out. And this is, of course, a prominent street in Gaza, one that many people went to as a refuge because it generally was spared some of the consequences that other areas have faced. We looked at a couple other strikes. We also documented Israeli airstrikes that wiped out some of Gaza's prominent high rises, so destroyed buildings that housed that had homes, businesses, so destroying livelihoods. For many, again, activities that, you know, violate clearly international humanitarian law, where there was, again, no apparent or evident military target. And that includes, of course, one building that housed the offices of Al Jazeera and Associated Press. And, you know, it's, of course, part of a larger pattern of just disregard, wanton disregard for the lives of Palestinians. And of course, we also looked at Palestinian rocket strikes into Israel, which also constitute violations of the laws of war and war crimes. They included misfires in Gaza that killed Palestinians in Gaza. We also looked at the events inside the demonstrations and communal violence in community mixed cities, between quotes, inside Israel. And we published research on that. We looked at social media media censorship, particular Facebook and Instagram, of content by Palestinians and their supporters. So we looked at many aspects of this, and again found serious abuses. But these abuses, of course, took place, and it's important to conclude to sort of note that in conclusion, against the backdrop, of course, of the escalating repression that was taking place in Jerusalem, including the efforts to force Palestinians out of their homes, which are, you know, really clear examples of apartheid and persecution. And of course, against the backdrop of Israel's crushing closure of Gaza, which has been at the core of the long-term restrictions of the rights of Palestinians living there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are any avenues for accountability that you sort of are optimistic about? That, for example, the United Nations Human Rights Commission last year launched this commission of inquiry into events. And I think we're supposed to be getting a report from that relatively soon. There's also last year, the International Criminal Court, was it last year or the year before, they launched the investigation into alleged war crimes in the OPT. Do you think any of these have a chance of obtaining accountability and justice?
Look, as a human rights activist, you have to be an optimist, or else, you know, why get up in the morning and do your job? But I do think there have been some significant efforts, including the ones you mentioned, that are worth highlighting. Let me start by saying, of course, that Israeli investigations, by the way, as well as investigations by Palestinians where they've committed serious abuses, are a whitewash mechanism. And so victims of serious abuses have faced a wall of impunity for years, for even decades. But I do think there are some efforts at the international level that are important. You mentioned the Commission of Inquiry, which is indeed due to issue its inaugural report in June, but that Commission of Inquiry is unique in that it has a standing mandate. So it's not just about doing a one-off report and then recommendations. They're going to issue several reports over time until obviously these underlying abuses are addressed. They also have a mandate to look on both sides of the green line, which is significant in and of itself. I think it's important that commission inquiry is quite important. It's staffed by, you know, three very highly respected commissioners, as well as a staff underneath them. There also, of course, is the International Criminal Court's formal probe. And that was, of course, opened at the end of the prior prosecutor's tenure at the International Criminal Court. There is now a formal probe that's ongoing. And Human Rights Watch has been calling for that for a long time. It's critical that the prosecutor advance that prosecution. The ICC was set up exactly to address situations like this, where the violations are grave and the climate of impunity pervasive. And I actually would go a step further in saying robustly pursuing the Palestine investigation is crucial to the ICC's very legitimacy. So I think those two are examples, but there are other, I think, efforts. There are UN mechanisms that are looking at various aspects of the reality on the ground, including the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, all of which have the potential to issue, you know, quite significant findings that I think would help to combat the quite serious abuses that we see on a continuing basis committed by the Israeli government, by other actors.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the Canadian government has been essentially opposed to most of those avenues, repeatedly intervening to try to block the ICC investigation. They haven't officially opposed the Commission of Inquiry, but they had an opportunity in December to abstain on a motion that would have defunded it. So rather than voting against that abstention, so not exactly a sign of confidence, and they expressed sort of reservations about it. So it's not clear that when there is a report, when there is an outcome, that that Canada would, it's not clear what position they take. So unfortunately, there's a lot of pushing on our end to make sure that, you know, once these things come out, that actually states like Canada respect the work that goes into that and echo those findings. We probably should wrap it up pretty quick, but, you know, given the current events of the past week, we're recording this on May 17th, you know, I did want to get your thoughts on the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, who listeners may know was shot in the head during an Israeli raid in Jenin in the West Bank last week. There were multiple eyewitness accounts who insist that she was deliberately targeted by Israeli forces, and that a position has been supported by two independent probes who say that that's the most likely scenario. And her employer, Al Jazeera, called it an assassination. A lot of outrage internationally, but very few people willing to actually criticize Israel. Whereas if I just think if this was a Ukrainian journalist who her eyewitness account said that she was killed by a Russian soldier, and this was backed by multiple probes, I don't think Canada would be waiting to condemn Russia for it. So it seems clear there's a double standard here. Do you have any thoughts on sort of this, on what's going on right now and what this says about the broader pattern of violence against journalists?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to just note is how gut-wrenching, you know, this killing is. And I think maybe for listeners in Canada, it's difficult to describe how much Shireen Abu Akleh was for so many Palestinians, a voice, you know, their voice narrating their story to the world. I'm currently in Jordan. I can tell you anecdotally just how significant this event, you know, was. And I think that the massive number of people that gathered for her funeral procession is a testament to that. And I think first and foremost, I think of her and the so many, you know, her colleagues, but also the many, many people she touched and how difficult this moment is. But I also am in awe, really, of her. I mean, you know, the fact that this reporter who for two decades has been documenting the ugliness of, you know, of the occupation and Israel's apartheid, you know, 6 a.m. rushed out to the front lines in Jenin to tell a story that wasn't being told well, frankly, that the nearly daily killings of Palestinians in recent days and weeks in circumstances that it's been difficult for people to tell. She wanted to tell that story. And, you know, I was very struck by her last report for Jazeera Arabic, for those who haven't seen, where she so powerfully in a couple of sentences narrated, you know, the Palestinian experience and her kind of patented, you know, kind of clear and way. And so I think I first and foremost think about Shireen and her colleagues. But I think beyond that, you know, the killing of Shireen obviously reflects the systematic use of excessive force and the disregard for Palestinian lives, you know, by the Israeli government. I mean, millions of Palestinians live a reality of daily structural violence and apartheid. There have been other journalists who have been injured and killed. I think of people in Gaza like Yasser Murtadha back in the March of Return, you know, and many, many others. And the reality is that, you know, this case got a lot of international attention, of course, given Shireen's, you know, work with, her, you know, kind of respected work that she's done over so many years. But, you know, this is a reality that Palestinians face quite often, that their best and brightest, their journalists, their, you know, their medical workers, their demonstrators, their activists are routinely killed, imprisoned, you know, for doing, you know, their work. So I think, it, you know, obviously there's been an outpouring, and rightfully so, for Shireen, but that needs to translate because, as you noted, governments have condemned the killing, but obviously without identifying, you know, the perpetrator, and general calls for accountability without, you know, and as you've noted, many of the same people that have actively undermined for many years actual efforts to hold perpetrators to account, like in the bodies that we mentioned earlier. So if we want to prevent, and I also want to note that back in 2019, the UN Commission of Inquiry made a clear finding based on detailed research that Israeli forces, quote, shot at journalists, knowing, you know, doing their job, knowing who they were. You know, that was several years ago. And again, we see the pattern repeating, right? People forget that another Al Jazeera reporter, Juvera, was herself had her arm broken recently in reporting around Jerusalem. You know, AP and Al Jazeera's offices were bombed. So there's a really ugly cycle that's sort of developed, or there's some event that, you know, amid daily killings of Palestinians that go unreported, that gets attention, the Israeli government puts forward misinformation, clouds, muddies the waters. So there is some sort of conflicted message. There's calls for accountability. Israel says it maybe will investigate or will investigate. Sometimes it doesn't even say that. And then the international community's attention goes elsewhere. And meanwhile, the Israeli government buries the work, whitewashes, and we see a repetition of the same things. I mean, just literally days after the brutality of the assault on people commemorating at the funeral of Shireen, of carrying her body. Again, we saw, mere days later, similar events take place at the funeral procession of another Palestinian. So, and that's literally when the world's attention is focused, completely on this reality. So imagine situations where the focus isn't there. That cycle needs to end. That cycle needs to end first and foremost by recognizing reality for what it is, apartheid. You need to recognize that reality. And then you need to sort of take the sorts of actions that are warranted by a situation of that gravity, including, as noted, the forms of accountability we've discussed, as well as states ending all forms of complicity in that crime.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Omar, so much for joining us today. We touched on a lot of important subjects. Do you have any final thoughts you want to share with Canadians before we let you go?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would just underscore, the point that I've been saying a long time, which is I think for those who, are still trying to understand the reality better, I think it starts by understanding that so much of what you might hear just in the kind of superficial understanding of the conflict is just detached from reality, right? Like a 55-year occupation is not a temporary, conflict, right? A 30-plus year peace process, isn't going to dismantle systematic, repression. And apartheid isn't some hypothetical future scenario. It's a lived reality for millions of Palestinians. And I think, it's clear as day, more and more calling it out for what it is. So if you're not one of those people who recognize that reality, read the reports. If you find something you disagree with, certainly, let Michael know, let myself know, post on social media. But, otherwise, I think it's important that we push governments, our representatives, to use that terminology. And then, not just to use the words, but then to sort of push for actions that are commensurate with an analysis like that. And I think there are important work to be done in places like Canada. And I very much hope that this shift that we're starting to see in the discussion can translate into improvements on the ground, because it hasn't so far, as witnessed by recent events we're seeing across Israel-Palestine. But, I do believe that if we keep speaking out, reporting, that eventually we can change that reality.
Great, absolutely. Thanks so much, Omar.
My pleasure.
If you're a listener and you've enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our podcast. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps other people to find our program and to learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. Thanks to all our supporters who help make this podcast possible. Thanks also to Madeline Moffett, our podcast engineer and consultant. Thanks for tuning in.